Andrew Yakubovich, thanks for being on the program.
Andrew West, happy to be with you.
When the census data is released tomorrow, is it likely to show Australia to be a more or less religious country?
It's going to show three things. Firstly, it's going to show that a higher proportion of the population are saying they have no religion. Secondly, it's going to show that particular groups of religious identification are growing. And thirdly, it's going to show that some parts of the Australian religious landscape are actually declining.
Now, you studied the particular intersection between immigration and religion, and you've given it very close consideration. How is immigration likely to affect the religious observance figures that show up?
Well, firstly, I think what we're going to see is that the non-Christian religions are going to be significantly greater than they have been in the past. The rate of growth over the last decade and a half of non-Christian religions has been really quite astronomical, from admittedly a very, very small base. That's going to be clearly there. We're going to see in some areas non-Christian religions for the first time having a majority of their population Australian-born rather than based simply being immigrant. And I think in other areas we're going to see some of the larger non-Christian religions getting very well established. As well, of course, there are significant contributions to the Christian communities of immigrants. Some of the African communities, for instance, are very strongly Christian. Some of the refugee groups from places like Iraq, India, and so on, or Pakistan, are going to be Christian. There are going to be significant claims from the new Chinese population for inclusion in the Christian communities.
We'll break those down in a minute. Mm-hmm. When you look at the big non-Christian faith groups, which ones are likely to have risen and risen dramatically when the results come out?
Well, the three big ones are Buddhism, Hinduism and Islam. And we're going to see some quite dramatic changes.
Well, on Islam, for example.
Islam in 2006 had around 340,000 adherents, of whom about 40% were Australian-born. It looks like there'll probably be somewhere between 450,000 and 500,000 Muslims in Australia as a result of last year's census. And probably for the first time, 50% or more of those will be Australian-born.
Is that because Muslim families tend to be larger?
It's not simply the family size, it's also the age structure of the Muslim population. Right? Most of the Muslims who arrive in Australia as immigrants are coming as young adults, so their family formation years are immediately in front of them. And yes, it is the case they tend to have larger families, or from particular ethnic groups they'll have larger families. And by now also Islam's been here so long that we're now into the second, third generation. People whose grandparents were immigrants are now having children. Right? And the identification in those communities with the Islamic faith is still very strong.
So as a percentage of the population, do we know roughly what it will be?
It will be somewhere about 2.5%, I would say, somewhere around that sort of figure, maybe higher than that even.
Let's look at Hinduism, for example. There's been a big rise in the number of people coming from the Indian subcontinent. How is that likely to affect the numbers of Hindus?
Well, we know, for instance, that the Indian-born population in Australia has increased by well over 100% over the last 5 years. I mean, it's really quite a huge increase. That being the case, I think it's likely that we'll be seeing somewhere in the vicinity of 250,000 Hindus, maybe more, identified in the next census. That makes them about a bit over 1% of the population.
And the other major group you mentioned were Buddhists. What are the figures going to show there?
Well, Buddhism's always been a slightly peculiar religion in Australia because there are a lot of non-Asian Australians who identify as Buddhists, and when asked in the census what religion they put down Buddhism, whether or not they're formally practicing. But for the most part, we're looking at people partly from India, mainly from places like Thailand. We're looking at people from other parts of Indochina and, of course, from China itself. It's likely, I think, that we'll be looking at a Buddhist population probably of over 600,000. That would make them also a bit over 3% of the population. Right, so these together, you know, we're seeing quite a transformation, if you like, in the faith landscape of Australia. These are no longer minorities. by minorities in the sense we thought of them as marginal in the past. What we're now looking at are groups that are large enough and concentrated enough to make a significant impact on the whole way in which we think about religious practice.
So cumulatively, the census data is likely to show the non-Christian population heading close to 8-9%.
I would say easily that sort of figure is now non-Christian. And that means that obviously the Christian population is going down. One of the impacts, for instance, of the Chinese immigration is actually to increase the number of people who report no religion, because coming out of a communist society, many of them have no faith base at all, even though in Australia their practices are rather different, perhaps.
And yet, Andrew, as you well know from your fieldwork, a lot of Christian congregations are swelling with Chinese parishioners. So how does that match up?
Well, I think it also depends which Chinese we're talking about. People from Hong Kong are much more likely, the new generation is much more likely to be Christian. Some of the Taiwanese are likely to be Christian. The PRC immigrants, possibly... Mainland Chinese, possibly less likely. But then they encounter Australian proselytising religions, particularly the Pentecostalists, who have particularly identified those communities. But there's also a long tradition, say, in the Baptist Church and in the Anglican Communion and so on, through missionary links and so on to the Chinese community. So there's a bit of that, but I would think the overarching impact of the big Chinese increase will not be seen particularly in the Christian churches, though particular Christian churches may suddenly discover or have been discovering that their congregations are in fact being transformed by Chinese arrivals, particularly in cities like Sydney.
Yes, we've talked about this a lot before. Uniting Church, a relatively small church, but its parish is being bolstered by Koreans and Pacific Islanders, for example.
That's right, and I think the Uniting Church is in fact flipping back now, well, not flipping back consciously, but it's now sort of drawing the benefit of its old missionary base. When the Methodists and Presbyterians went wandering around all over the South Pacific, the seeds that were sown many decades ago are now coming home to roost.
Even though the way that it might seem is a big change, of course, faith in Australia has been multicultural for a very long time. As you well know, for 60, 70 years, we've had one of the largest Greek Orthodox populations. What is, though, basically different about this? I mean, why is this almost revolutionary?
Well, you asked me the question specifically about non-Christian, and I think that's what's changing. There's a non-Christian dimension, right, which raises at the point, you know, if we're looking at sort of 8 or 9% of the population not being Christian, there then becomes an issue about how the rhetoric of Australian morality, for instance, is affected. If Australian politicians like the former Prime Minister, John Howard, talk about, you know, Judeo-Christian moralities, what do you do when a significant part of the Australian middle class is neither Christian nor Jewish, but quite attached to conservative political choices, for instance? So I think there's going to be some interesting questions about the way in which the rhetoric of the nation is framed over the next decade or so as these sorts of things change. The other thing I think which is going to be fascinating is to see what happens to the alliances on social issues that are going to emerge with these very, very important non-Christian communities. For instance, opposition to gay marriage, issues around abortion, questions about divorce and so on. Many of these issues, conservative Jews, conservative Muslims, conservative Christians, line up together. And we've already seen some of those alliances starting to be voiced around the question of gay marriage.
Andrew, one of the things that comes out of your analysis is that while you say there's going to be a rise in the number of those identifying as not religious, is it the case that those growing groups, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, for example, wear their religion a lot more seriously, that it's not a lightly held religion, and does that show up in the data?
For Muslims, I think there is an increasing political identification there, but also the practice of the Islamic faith is in fact extending, and the role of the Islamic schools in bolstering the faith in the second generation is really quite extraordinary. I mean, it's having a major, major impact. In relationship to Buddhism, that's, I think, a more complicated thing. People who would identify as Buddhists would also, to some extent, be concerned about paying respects to their ancestors. So there's a sort of familial cultural dimension of it that doesn't require any particular theistic model. And in fact, One of the issues, for instance, for people like religious Muslims is how do they relate to people like Buddhists? Muslims in their conversations are very comfortable with Christians and Jews because they come from a monotheistic tradition in which many of the stories and narratives overlap. Sometimes they find it more difficult to deal with religious beliefs which come from different traditions altogether. And at the more extreme end, we've seen that in places like Afghanistan, obviously. So the practicing of the religion in each case has a very different cultural frame. But it is the case, if you like, at the more intense end, that part of it is spreading. If you can think of a curve with a tail on it, at the more intense end of that, there's a lot more activity. The tail is still very long, though.
Andrew, for many people who've been observing or following the multiculturalism debate for 20 years, one of the interesting things now seems to be that when we talk about immigration and multiculturalism, religion is a much greater feature. Are the immigration statistics and the census data likely to add to that?
Yes, I think what's going to become even clearer out of the census is how important religious diversity has become as part of the national conversation about multiculturalism. And there are probably three reasons for this, I think. 20 years ago, the direction of the delivery of social and government programs was through government or secular non-government organisations. Today, it's heavily through religious-based institutions.
In effect, that means you go to the mosque or the temple and you get information about public services?
The mosque, the temple and so on have become very much more the focal point for the thinking about delivery of various sorts of community services. Many community organisations are now religiously focused rather than, say, if you like, ethnically focused. The second thing is that there's been this huge expansion of religious education so that the middle classes, which are very heavily immigrant and ethnic, are drawn much more towards religious schooling. Right? So that the issues around government involvement in funding religious schooling impacts much more widely, and it's inflected by these very important ethnic dimensions that weren't there 20 years ago or weren't there in anything like the same sort of way. And I guess the third component is that the proportion of the population which is now led by people who are identified religiously as well as ethnically means that any public debate about the direction of multicultural in Australia is dominated by questions about faith rather than other issues. And in fact, if you look at where government spending has gone in these sorts of areas, the redirection of funding from secular organisations to faith-based organisations in all sorts of ways has really been quite dramatic, ranging from the investment in security. So if you go to Attorney General's department, it's putting money into faith-based organisations, right, because of concerns about these issues. The welfare organisations are. Education, as I've mentioned, health, various sorts of social services, settlement services and so on.
That leads me to an interesting final point. You mentioned the middle class. Among immigrant communities that you have studied and studied closely, how much is religion a vehicle for class advancement?
That's a whole other program, I think, and there's some fascinating issues that question raises. I think recognition or acceptance by the community as being someone of ethical and moral standing, which is partly what religious leadership is about, plays a critical role in economic networks of various sorts. So there's no doubt that religious practices play part of that. Probably more interestingly, it's the movement of some of these ethnic communities into the Christian churches and their intersection there interaction there with middle class people of Anglo-Australian or other ethnic Australian backgrounds that provide them with new opportunities. And so the churches, as they've always played this role, actually provide certain sorts of avenues for economic advancement.
But aren't religious leaders of all faiths always out there encouraging education, encouraging personal improvement? I mean, isn't that a hallmark of that upward class mobility for many multicultural communities?
Education is clearly an important way forward. And there is a whole debate, as you know, about the role of faith-based schools, whatever the religion, as avenues for instilling ethical behaviour and ethical practices in young people as they grow up. So I think that's right, that as these schools develop, religious-based ethical visions of the world become more and more pervasive in the middle class, whereas over the last 20 or 30 years, religious-based ethical viewpoints have in fact declined amongst, say, the old Anglo-Australian middle class.
Well, Professor Andrew Jakubowicz, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew.